Today we're going to talk about hiring and why it's and how it's changed and why it's so important to make every hire count. You might not be a manager, but the way the hiring processes have been evolving, many people from the senior level of systems administration, SRE DevOps, however you self-identify right now, are becoming part of the hiring process. Whether you're marking tech tests, evaluating workplace samples, doing tech interviews, or even a lot of teammates are now becoming involved in what we call the fit interview to make sure that, you know, the people we're bringing onto the team are a good fit. It's important to understand how the hiring of systems administrators, SREs, DevOps, production engineers, however we identify, have changed over the last 15, 20 years and evolved just like every other system that we've been managing. So a quick introduction. My name is Chris Stankitis. I have been doing systems administration, SRE DevOps type work since the mid-90s. I started out in the ISP world like many of the people who are of the same vintage of me did. I've moved into different industries such as financial, telecom, Web 2.0, and social media. I'm now working for a company called Pythian. We are a premium consulting company. It's a very challenging environment because we have, you know, up to 20 clients that we're supporting at any given time on our team, and each client has their own individual technology stack, each individual networking stack. They have their own workflows. They have their own ways of working. I've been essentially doing what we're now calling DevOps, SRE, production engineering for the last 10 years, like a lot of us have, heavily focused on automation, scaling, you know, awesome deployments that don't suck, all of that good stuff. And, you know, over the last few years, I've had the opportunity to really begin advocating and evangelizing for the role, the evolving role of the systems administrator within our industry and inside of our community. So again, I work for Pythian. This is not a sales pitch. This is just kind of setting the stage. We hire a lot of people. I hire about 25 people a year just for the systems administration SRE group. That we do more outside of that, of our database consulting groups, all that type of stuff. But I'm hiring 25 people a year. And I found out really quick in this journey that our process was horribly broken. And I asked, I said, the process is horribly broken. And they went, yeah, we know the process is horribly broken. But some of the other parts of our company, they might only hire one or two people a year. They're mostly dealing with just churn. They're not really growing. So, you know, it was never really worth fixing the process when you're only hiring two people a year. And I said, well, we're doing over 100% growth. We're hiring like 25 people a year. You know, we're, you know, two new teams a year plus dealing with just your normal churn. This isn't going to work. So about a year ago, I stopped managing teams, like day-to-day team management, and I moved in, I handed my teams over to another team manager to take care of and to continue to grow. And I moved into a role that focused on hiring and refactoring our hiring system to ensure that we were bringing on board, you know, the right people, the 21st century definition of the systems administrator or SRE or production engineer or whatever we want to be called this week. And it was a really interesting process to go through right from the very beginning of, you know, when someone clicks, you know, writing out that job description for LinkedIn or whatever, all the way through up to the contract. So I basically spent the last year refactoring the hiring process along with our HR team, and it became like a consistent rubric that we're now using, then cascading down to the rest of the business. So, like I said, just like everything else, the hiring process has evolved. And it's because we were at a plateau for a while where we were able to just kind of say, we have a hiring process, it's working well, But, you know, just like our technology platforms have been evolving, the hiring process now has to evolve to catch up. You know, in the old days, we would have a fundamental thinking of the person that we want to hire, the person that we want to bring on needs to have the technology parity. They need to have the technology overlap. And we would basically play like a bingo game or go fish. And you say, oh, do you have Nginx? Yep. Oh, do you have Tomcat? Yes. Oh, do you have this? You have yes. And the person with the most would win. The problem with that paradigm, the problem with that model is it's kind of like the trivia show game show model. The person who was getting hired was the person who knew the most technology. And for a while there, that worked because we were on a technological plateau, or at least a lot of us were, where everything was kind of stable, everything was kind of standard. There was innovation going on, but it hadn't really trickled down to the masses yet. There was absolute innovation going on, but most companies weren't doing that. Most companies had a pretty good sweet spot there for a quite a big period of time where technology was stable, what we were using the technology for was pretty stable, and so you had this ability to hire people based on a game show model. You basically came up with that, I call it alphabet soup, of what you'd see on the job description, and you could just check things off. The more a person knew, the more qualified they were for the job. You know, this rewarded regurgitation, though. It rewarded the person, again, who knew the most and not necessarily the person who had the most potential. And that's where we're kind of coming to now, is we're hitting this intersection of the new and the old. You know, we're now getting to the point where in the olden days, you know, we would be able to ask a question like this, and we would get an answer like that. We would be able to say, how do you put a second IP on your box? And we would get that answer back. But today, you're just as likely to get an answer like that to the same question. You're going to get, you know, 3 lines of Puppet code. And that just happens to be Puppet code because I know Puppet. But the point being is, we're starting to hit a point in time now where people are working less and less with the systems, and the way that they're answering the questions that we're asking out there are not kind of in the old, what we would have answered the question 10 years ago, maybe even longer, 15 years ago. You know, but you know, it also kind of speaks to what happens when we have incidents. You know, 15 years ago, when your server went down, it was a big problem. It was a panic situation. It was all hands on deck. But now we have the ability to have redundancy and resiliency, high availability, anti-fragility. And generally, if one server goes down, in theory, it's not a single point of failure. It's in a load balancing pool. You have 8 other servers doing that same job, hopefully, and if one goes down, you're not even necessarily getting paged in the middle of the night anymore. It's a shift that I've heard called cattle, not cats. In the old days, we would treat our servers like they were pets. We would have emotional attachments to them. Everyone has that server that they remember pouring their blood and sweat and tears into. They were highly customized and generally poorly documented. So when they went down, there was a lot of anxiety that whether or not they would come back, you know? Would they come back? Would they come back with everything that they had on them when they went down? I worked with a person who had the unfortunate, horrible habit of not committing routes to the route file on disk. And the box would come up and it would be missing 2 or 3 routes. You know, can we relied a lot on backup and restore because we didn't actually know if we could really rebuild those boxes. You know, we give them host names of planets or Star Trek or all of those things that created emotional attachment. And because we put so much work and so much personal blood, sweat, and tears into these boxes, there was a huge amount of investment into bringing them back up and a huge amount of investment into keeping them healthy. In the modern paradigm, however, we've moved to a point where everything should be repeatable, homogenized, and no single box should be something that's so special that we can't just shoot it in the head and bring a new one up to take its place. If a box is misbehaving, we shoot it in the head, we bring a new one up, we maybe save that container to do a postmortem, or we might not even do that. Hopefully we do it, but we might not. The point being is that we're now getting to a point now where we have less of an emotional attachment over our infrastructure on a micro level. You know, we might be really proud of what we've done on a bigger scale. Absolutely, that's great. But we're no longer worrying about single boxes, like what happens if I reboot this server? Is that going to come back up? Is it going to have all its routes? Is it going to have all of its configuration? Is it going to work? We can use this paradigm shift to allow us to manage better boxes at scale. And what this translates back into the hiring focus is that you're going to get people who are applying who are of the older mindset, and you're going to get people who are applying who are of the newer mindset. But that's not the problem. Whether someone gives you the old answer on how to add a NIC IP address to the NIC using, you know, ETH0.0 or ETH0:0, or whether they give you the three lines of Puppet code, that's not the problem, because, you know, we can still pretty much measure that. It's still something that we're good at measuring. And one of the challenges of being a highly technical person who transitions into a management role is that we're really good at measuring people's technological ability. So what's the problem? You know, we can really measure people's technological ability well. But as I mentioned earlier, we're starting to see a shift where what you've been doing in the past isn't as directly relevant to the work you'll be doing in the present or even in the future. I found this, and I think the middle slide sums it up. We're quickly moving towards a youth-oriented culture where technology is moving so quickly that what you did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even a few years ago, aren't how we do it again today, or how we would do it again if we were to kick off the same project today. And in this youth-oriented culture, in this culture where technology is moving so quickly, in this push for velocity, where companies are becoming more risk tolerant to abandoning systems for the one that will cut down their release time by an extra 10 or 15 seconds, or you might have someone who's working with a technology 3 or 4 months and they're considered your expert because the technology itself might only be 6 months old. So, you know, generally to date, we've been relying heavily on people's technical skills. We were at a plateau, technology was very stable, the innovation was happening high above us, it hadn't trickled down yet, and we were in a position where we could just choose the person who knew the most about the technology we were working with. But now we're moving to a point in time where the technology that we need to work with hasn't even come down to us yet. Innovation is trickling down to us faster, and there's a stronger business need to be able to move faster. So we now have to start evaluating soft skills. And this is very difficult for technical people because really, honestly, it's a lot of tree-hugging, hippie, slam poetry stuff that we may or may not be very good at. The problem with soft skills, and I did this, at my company we have about 50 different teams and each team has a manager, and those managers are hiring managers for their teams. So I pulled the people on my company. And again, they hire at very different rates. Our open source database hire much more than our Oracle guys. But right now, SRE is the one who are hiring the most. So I pulled all of our team managers and I said, hey guys, you know, we were chatting in one of our team manager peer support group meetings, and I said, when you guys are doing a fit interview, the hiring manager interview, I said, how long in until you know if you've got the right guy? And the scary thing that came out of that was pretty consistently, most people agreed that they knew in the first 5 minutes whether the person was the right person for the job. And what's dangerous about that is it means that pretty much everyone was hiring on gut. And I don't want to at all downplay the importance of gut feeling when it comes to these type of decisions. Oftentimes your gut is telling you something that you're not picking up on, and it's important to listen to it. But oftentimes we've been trained as people to ignore our gut feelings. We're not 100% sure whether or not that's the right message or not. We often contradict our gut feelings. So what was happening is these guys were doing an hour-long fit interview. They were making a decision about a person, and then they were spending the next 55 minutes trying to validate their decision, whether they were deciding that they have the right person or whether they were deciding they had the wrong person. And so this is confirmation bias in action. And the problem with that is when you're shifting your focus from your technical and no longer looking for the most technical person, when you're looking for a great technological foundation and trying to move more to hiring someone based on their soft skills, when you're making that decision in the first 5 minutes and then just spending the rest of the time confirming it, you're not really doing a good job at evaluating the soft skills. And it comes back to the fact that technical people are great at evaluating technology and evaluating a person's capabilities with that technology, and we have to learn how to evaluate some of the softer and squishier stuff. You know, job descriptions these days sound like they belong more on OkCupid than they do on LinkedIn. You know, you're looking for someone who has a growth mindset, who can inspect and adapt to new situations, who likes walks on the beach and Barry Manilow. That is what our job descriptions are starting to turn into. Gone are the days of technological soup, because we don't often even know the technology that we're going to be working with a year from now because of the move in risk tolerance to throwing out the old technology and bolting in a new technology for greater performance or velocity. So, you know, so our job ads are starting to sound like dating requests. I mean, if you take a look at some of the job ads on the board here at Lisa, they're not asking for almost any qualifications. They're just saying, do you want to work for a company where you can make a change and do something good for the world, or, you know, stuff like that. It's they're looking to enter into a relationship. So how are we going to fix this? Well, right now I identify as an SRE, and SRE is all around metrics. So we need to figure out how to put some data around these soft skills, around these non-technical attributes, and we have to get to a point where we can do data-driven hiring so that we at least have something to back up the gut feeling. Again, don't throw the gut feeling out, but make sure that you have some data to back up the gut feeling. I've actually seen in over the year when we've implemented this one or two times where you weren't really too hot on the guy, but then when you went back and did the evaluation and you looked at the notes, you went, wow, they're a lot stronger than I actually felt they were when I talked to them. And that's been some interesting points of self-reflection as to, you know, why did you feel that way? What was it about that initial interaction that caused you to make the decision that that person, you weren't too hot on that person? But then when you looked at the data later, it started to prove you wrong. So like I said, the first thing we need to do is measure all of the things. But how do you measure someone's growth potential? How do you measure someone's ability to learn things quickly? How do you measure if someone has time management skills? First of all, you have to, just like your technical skills, you have to identify what non-technical skills are important to you. It was actually a few years ago when I was here in DC for the last Lisa that was here that I was very cognizant around time management and the fact that I had inherited a team that did not have very good time management. And I talked to Tom Lumencelli and I said, Tom, what can I do? Like, can I buy everybody on my team a copy of your book and force them to read it? And can I fly you into my company and have you give this session to my entire company pretty much? This time management problem is a big thing. I need people who have good time management skills. And he looked at me and he said, if you want people who have good time management skills, then you have to hire people who have good time management skills. And what Tom was getting at, and it took me a while to understand that because it just seemed too easy. I'm like, okay, so what's the catch here? Like, just don't hire people who aren't good at time management. And I'm like, oh, of course, just don't hire people who are good at time management. But what Tom was really saying, and what it really drove home in this part of my presentation, is you have to identify what traits are important to you as a business and as a manager and for your team. As much as we do that, and we do that, we have that down when it comes to technical. That's the alphabet soup of our stack. This is our stack, and these are what we need you to know to be able to work at our company. But we don't often do the yin to the yang, where we go to the soft skills and say, this is what we need. I need someone, if I need someone who has time management skills, then that needs to be a trait that I identify and that I look for in people when I hire them. I want people working for me who have a growth mindset. I want people who want to learn new things and play with new technology and continue to grow. I want different people next year from the people I had the year previously through growth. So that's an important skill to me. I need people who value work-life balance, have something that they do that's more than the sum of their parts, so that they will take time off and not burn out. Our company is about 70% work from home, so people sometimes have a challenge turning off at 5 o'clock and going and doing something else because they're always in their house. Some people need that commute in order to shift gears. So I have to look and identify that for the people I'm hiring. So the first thing you need to do is you have to understand, okay, well, what traits am I hiring? And you can't pick 100. As much as you'd want to, you have to narrow that down. Again, just like with our technology, we can't just ask people, like, to get my point home about the technology soup on job applications and how useless it was, I actually put UUCP on my job applications just to see if anyone would ever call me on it. And I had one person go, do you really actually need someone who still knows UUCP in 2014? And I went, no, I was just putting that on there to see if anyone was actually paying attention to these job requirements. But just like that, we would put this list like this of technologies that we need when we only really needed a quarter of them. And then we would hire the person who knew more just because we might need something. The same type of thing with the soft skills. You have to kind of pare that down. The next thing you have to do with your soft skills is you have to assign a weighting to that trait. You have to go and say, okay, well, you know, what's my most important thing? You know, everything that you identify as a trait that you want to put on your evaluation is something that a person should have. But there are things that are lines in the sand, and there's some things where you have some wiggle room. Growth mindset for us was a line in the sand. If we had someone who just wanted to punch the clock, and didn't want to help grow the company, help grow themselves, help better the team, that was a line in the sand. The time management thing was a line in the sand. And a few other things were line in the sands, and then other things were, we want them, but they're not as important. It's still on the evaluation, so we still want to evaluate that, but it's not as important as other things. So you have to weight these things. So we did a 1 to 5 weighting scale, and we said 5 are our most important things and 1 are our least important things, but things we still want because they're still on the evaluation. But what it meant is that if one of our nice to have things was, someone who wanted to work with charity, someone who wanted to give back to the community, and maybe that was rated a 1, and maybe they scored a 5 on that. Maybe they were a girl guide leader or a scouts leader or something like that, and they're working with the community. They're working with that. Oh, that's really great. They have this charitable thing going on. That's really great. But that was weighted as a 1, and so they scored a 5 on that. Overall, in the evaluation, they only got 5 points for that. So what happens by weighting your traits is that you allow those important traits to bubble up to the top, and you don't end up in gridlock where you have a person who's arguing to hire someone because they scored great in desire to be charitable and had nothing in growth mindset or had nothing in organization skills or time management. So first, you have to pick your traits, and then you have to weight your traits. And you have to remember that unicorns are rare. So you have to decide where your line in the sand is for a pass and then an exceptional pass. So we have a requirement at my company to grade everything out of 5. So for us, it was basically 3 was the minimal acceptable grade in any category. And if you scored under 3 in one category, you were a conditional pass, because then the hiring manager could decide if that was something they could work with, that maybe someone else on the team was could overcompensate for that. If you got under a 3 in 2 categories, that was a fail. And the reason why we're putting a lot of emphasis on the soft skills is because if you look into the creation, the breaking, and the forming of new habits, it's really hard. It is very hard to break habits. It is very hard to create new habits and instill new mindsets in the people who you hire. It goes back to Tom Lumencelli's talk. Like, he's like, you could buy a copy of my book for everybody on your team. And he said, I will thank you for that very much, because I will be getting paid for that. My publisher will be very happy, but it's not going to work. And that's what he told me, like right out to my face. He said, it is not going to work, because you have to have the person who is in the right mindset at the right time to be willing to accept that change, to allow them to take that change to heart and create new habits around that. It's the whole lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink analogy. So what Tom was saying when he was saying, if you want people who have good time management skills, you have to hire them, was that it is a lot easier or it is a lot more advantageous to focus your hiring on getting someone who has the highest amount of non-technical soft skills that you're looking for, and a very strong technology foundation. I'm not advocating for hiring non-technical people. They have to have that strong foundation. But you can send a person out on course, you can give them training, and in general, they'll come back and they'll be able to work with that new technology, hopefully, a lot faster than you can hand someone a copy of Tom's book and say, come back in a week and have your time management challenges sorted out. So that's also where there's been a bit of a paradigm shift. You hire the people based on soft skill alignment with a strong technical foundation, because it is a lot easier for people to pick up technology, at least in our space, than it is for you to break habits and form new habits and instill new mindsets on your team. So once you have your traits picked out, and once you have your weighting for those traits, you have to pick supporting questions that allow you to evaluate the traits. And some of this comes from Google. I give them full credit, because just like everything, they kind of innovated in this area, even in hiring. And that information has started to trickle down. They've released a book on their hiring practices, which is a really cool book. And they advocate, they used to be the ones who would ask like the strangest questions, you know, like how many ping pong balls can you fit in a 747, right? And they found that regurgitative trivia just wasn't finding the right people. So what they moved to is a paradigm of asking very simple questions. And a very simple question will allow for the cream to rise to the top. So I'm going to use a technical example, because it will really resonate well with the audience. But one of our questions could be, "What happened? Tell me everything that happens from the point in time where you press in the power button to the point in time where you get the login prompt for your computer." That's a very open-ended question. It's a very vague question, and it will get you an incredibly wide range of answers. Everything from someone who's very junior, who will talk about, the BIOS does this, and then the operating system boots up, and then I get my command prompt, to the guy who can sit there and start talking about the different rails on the power supply, powering up what parts of the motherboard boot up in what sequence. The microkernel gets loaded up, it does this, it hands off to this space gets created, everything gets loaded in. that answer can be anything from a two-minute answer to a person can speak for over 40 minutes on that from one simple question. So by asking a simple question with a very wide-opened answer, you can really evaluate someone's ability based on to what depth they can talk to that subject. It also means for an interview that you're not asking 100 questions. You're asking some very simple questions that can have very complicated answers. But they're all supporting the traits that you want to evaluate. So if you've evaluated, if you have a trait around growth mindset, then you need to have a question around growth mindset. You need to ask, you know, what technology have you worked on in the last 6 months? What do you want to work on in the next year? Do you have a training plan for it? What resources are you using? And then look at the answer that you get from there. You can ask people, you know, a very simple question of where do you see the industry moving in the next 5 to 10 years? And then some people can talk very simply to that question, and some people can talk very at depth at that question. And this is what will help you evaluate the traits. So to the length and depth at which someone can speak to a topic will help you decide whether they are a 1 or whether they're a 5 in that particular category. And so what do we end up with? You know, we end up with a way to take our non-technical data and evaluate it and come up with a score ranking that we can evaluate candidates against, both on a horizontal trait by trait level, but also on an overall strength level. I know many of you out there probably understand the Swiss cheese security model, meaning you have multiple layers. Every layer has holes in it, but the holes don't align. So if it gets through the first layer, it gets blocked at the second layer, et cetera, et cetera. And this model is absolutely the same for when you're building a team. You're going to have some people who have some strengths in one area and weaknesses in the other, and you want to make sure that when you're bringing on a new person that their strengths complement the weaknesses that you have on your team and that their weaknesses are covered by other members. So this way you can now evaluate that on a row-by-row basis based on the traits that you've picked out and weighted and as an overall scoring. And so when you're only hiring one person at a time, this is an exercise that helps you overcome the bias. But where this really excels is when you have to make a choice between 4 different people for a single role. And they've all passed your test. And you're like, oh yeah, these are all good people. But now you have to pick the best person. And by doing this exercise, by making sure that you're looking at what traits are important and how that person answered the questions that helped you evaluate those traits, you will then hopefully be able to choose the strongest person. We need to do this because there is a significant cost to mishires. There's a lot of time put into the hiring cycle. A lot of people put many hours into finding the right candidate and bringing the right person on. And moving beyond the financial, and what's even more important is there's a huge impact to the team when you bring on someone who just doesn't fit, who isn't keeping up, who is having challenges, and then to have to go through the process of parting ways with that person and finding a new person is demoralizing and costly. So one of the most important jobs that a manager could do is build a team. We're no longer the hands-on people that we once were. It's our job to build a team of people who can execute on our needs based on what we have to deliver to the business. So hiring is actually one of the most important things that a manager does. And unfortunately, in a lot of organizations, it's something that is like an unused muscle. It's something that's only done once every few years. You might have a smaller team, everyone's happy, and then Joe gets a new job, he goes off to Google, and you have to bring on a new team member. When you're hiring 25 people a year, like I am, I'm always hiring. We're always in a hiring cycle. And so we're pretty in shape when that comes to that. When you're only hiring for a small team every few years, it is also more critically important that you have a great process in place as well, because you're not constantly having fresh candidates come across you to refine that process in your head. So we've hired people, we've achieved victory, we have a happy team, everything is great. The one thing that needs to be stated, and I'm not going to spend time on it because it is an entire other talk onto its own, is hiring is just the first phase. The retention is very important as well. People are like plants, are like seeds. You can't just throw people into any environment and hope that they will flourish. You can't just hire a bunch of DevOps people and say, poof, now we're doing DevOps. You need to make sure that you, right back to the beginning when you're identifying the people you want to hire, you identify the culture that you want to create and you identify the environment that you want to create to allow these people to be most successful. And if you don't do that, then you're going to be unhappy because even the best people will wither up and die if you don't give them the right environment to work in. So again, the quick plug, I work for Pythian. We hire a lot of people. Like I said, 70% of the company works from home out of their home offices. We do have some offices around the world depending on where people live, but most people like the work from home option. We're a pretty cool employer. If you're ever looking for a change, consider checking out our website to see if we have something that might fit for you. And if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them for the last few minutes. And as reminded earlier, please use the microphone.
I'm actually going to use my prerogative as the session chair to ask the first question. This is such an important topic. Thank you for the talk. One of our problems in hiring, and I say our, I mean everyone's problems, is we have a bias towards hiring the person who looks just like us, mm-hmm. both in terms of gender and things like that, but yep. also technical experience and approach to problems. Have you found that this helps, or are we just feeling better about our biases because we assigned numbers to them and called them data?
No. So what does help, though, is identifying that diversity is something that you need to hold as a key value, as a key trait that you want to hire for. They've done a lot of studies and a lot of work on diversity and how having a non-diverse team of people who are all cookie cutter, look alike, work alike, think alike, really doesn't lead to innovative solutions. Whether you come from a marginalized part of society like the LGBTQ segment, women, people of color, everyone has different life experiences and different perspectives because of the lens that they look through in their daily life that they bring to their work. So hiring for diversity doesn't happen unless you make a decision to hire for diversity. And then just like creating an exciting work environment for your technical people to thrive in, you have to create an environment that diversity is allowed to thrive in and that people who are in marginalized sectors of our society feel safe, that they can work in that environment and express themselves authentically and have the support of the business.
So when you guys do the interviews, how many people usually get onto these interviews? I mean, is it a team
interview? That's a great question, actually. So we have a policy where we're not allowed to have one person make any decision. We're not at the point yet where some companies are at where they kind of randomize everything and they just say, hey, person in accounting, you're going to help out with an interview for an SRE today. No, we're not at that point yet. I know some companies have moved to that area where they're starting to pull in random people for, again, that diversity. But right now we have policies that say once you start getting up to our fit interview stage, you cannot just be hired by the hiring manager. There's usually a second manager there, an HR person there, and now we're bringing in members from our teams. So if we're hiring for a team, we will just pick one of the random guys on that team and say, hey, you're gonna come on here. Part of the thing that's nice about this process is because you have to identify your traits and you have to create questions that allow you to evaluate the traits, is that our questions, we have a pool of questions that relate to each trait, so we can just bring someone in from the team and say, hey, you're gonna ask these two or three questions, here's the follow-ups, don't worry about what the person says, that our HR person takes all the notes, and this is how our evaluation works. Everyone gets trained on how they evaluate after that. So you don't need a lot of prep time to jump into one of our interviews. If you're just a team member who's being brought in to give some impression on it on the person being interviewed.
One more question: how many interviews do you think is kind of enough to decide on?
Well, every company has their own rate, but right now, you go through everyone has their entire hiring policy slightly different. So ours starts with a test. Still, we're working on changing that around, but today it still starts with a test. Which is kind of common. It's actually kind of scary the amount of people who just don't return the test. And then we have about a 50% fail rate on our test. We actually want to make that a little more difficult because our technical interview, which is the next stage after the phone screening, which happens after you return the test, is about a 60% fail rate. So right now there's a little bit of a disconnect in our process where of the 50% of the people who are passing the test, 60% of those fail the tech interview. So we want to make our test a little more difficult to cut down on the amount of technical interviews that we're doing and hopefully have a higher success rate on those ones. So that's part of our next phase of refactoring. Of the people who make it through, say, of the four, Chris is bad at math, of the four people who make it through the technical interview to a fit interview, usually there will be one higher out of that, but that's not necessarily the case as well. So all in all, in total, we have about a 50 to 60 applicants to hire ratio. Hiring, when it comes down to it, is really it's fishing. It's just putting a number of people through until you find the right people with the right fit. Excellent, thank you.
Have you taken any steps to reduce unconscious biases from the scoring of your soft skills? So when someone's scoring an answer, how do they make it so that their personal biases don't come into, it's like, I don't like people who wear green shirts, therefore they give the same answer as someone who wore a red shirt.
Yep.
I'm going to be much harder because they miss a small detail as opposed to someone who is.
Yep, absolutely. So again, part of having the set questions and follow-up questions, we also have a bit of a scoring guide as well. And this is also, I'm not saying we've solved this problem perfectly, but this is also where not allowing to just have one hiring manager on the interview helps, because we have a minimum of four people who are filling out the evaluation form independently. We don't share our answers. And so when we get four, we can see if there's any outliers, and then we can figure out that on a case-by-case basis. So right now, four people are evaluating the person, four people are scoring them, and then we can do a comparison at the end.
Have you found that this process is increasing the diversity of the people you're hiring, or are you not really sure?
Well, as I mentioned, it doesn't increase the diversity unless you make diversity a trait that you're hiring for, which we do. So, we have a commitment to trying to hire women in technology, LGBT people, people of color, traditional marginalized people. We also hire around the globe. We are a 24/7 company. We do the follow the sun model. So we have a lot of cultural diversity where we'll hire people in Europe, Asia Pacific, India, North America, South America, Canada, which is where I'm from. So diversity for us, cultural diversity, we have no problem with that. When we start talking about gender diversity and life experience diversity for marginalized communities, that's something we identify as a trait that we want to hire for and that we want to target. And that's a lot of the job of our TA, our talent acquisition people. We have a full-time talent acquisition team of 8 people plus 3 or 4 sourcers. And when we say, you know, we want a person from North America and we want to try and find, you know, someone who is diverse from what we already have on the team, then we kind of put our order in, and they do an amazing job and come back with candidates for us to interview. Now, I mean, we will not hire someone just because we need the right person, but, you know, to quote my new prime minister, it's 2015, and, you know, it's important for us to have that diverse set of thought and diverse set of life experience on our teams to deliver the best to all of our clients.
We can take one question if it's quick.
Yep.
About how often do you rework your soft skills questions?
Continuously. We do continuous improvement. Just think a good old IDLE, where any of the people who've been doing the interviews can express some concerns. We were evaluating risk awareness and risk management, and people weren't answering the question right. Like we were saying, like, you know, what techniques do you do to manage risk on production systems? And we were getting answers consistently on how they would solve the problem instead of how they would manage the risk. So we brought it up to kind of our HR refactoring committee, our HR testing. You know, we have a group of people, including our principal consultants and HR people and stuff like that, whose job it is to refactor this stuff. And we said, look, this question isn't working. Everyone's answering it as how to solve the problem, not how to manage the risk. So we refactored the question. We tried it out. Everyone agreed we were now getting the data we were looking for, and everything was great. So, you know, we're continually looking to improve on the process. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Chris, for a great talk and great questions from the audience.